Hello and welcome to Radio Democracy for another week. My name's Linda. I'll be here with you until 1 p.m. Today I'm joined by some very special guests. We've got Lou Rice from the Atomic Ex-Servicemen's Association and Holly Zwolf from the Queensland Environmental Activist Network Queen. She's the convener. Today is the 50th anniversary of the first atomic bomb test conducted on the Australian mainland. So that will be the focus of Radio Democracy today. At Emu Junction on the 15th of October 1953, a full-scale atomic bomb codenamed Totem 1 was detonated. Totem 1 sent a dense radioactive cloud, the black mist, far beyond the testing range, across northwest South Australia. The nuclear fallout spread right through, causing immediate and long-term sickness and death amongst Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians. This test in the Australian desert was the beginning of one of the most tragic legacies of Australia's history with the nuclear industry. During the 1950s and 60s, the British government, with the support of the Australian government, tested atomic bombs at Emu Junction and Maralinga. These atomic tests not only left a legacy for Indigenous people and inhabitants of the affected area, but also on members of the army who were involved. So today's show, we've got Lou Rice from the Atomic Ex-Servicemen to talk about his experience and the experiences of the servicemen involved in the tests. And Holly Zwolf is going to talk about the Indigenous involvement, as she was just down in Cooper Pedy for the bush camp they had down there. But first of all, we'll go to a song and come back and talk to Lou.
This is Station Easy. A message has gone out today. The first trial of an atomic weapon on the mainland of Australia successfully completed.
And you just heard from Justin Mullins and Totem One. Well, the test in 1953 was the first on the mainland of Australia. The first test on Australian territory and involving Australian personnel occurred on October 2nd, 1952 at Montebello. Our guest today, Lou Rice, was present at that test after having been conscripted for 6 months in the National Service. It's great to have you in here, Lou.
Thank you, Linda.
Thanks for coming in.
I'm delighted to be able to say a few words on the nuclear explosions in Australia and how they affect people and the nation generally.
Yeah, you've come in before, actually. 2 years ago you came in on it was in October. It wasn't the 15th, but it was must have been nearby. It was a National Day of Action Against the Nuclear Industry.
That's right.
Yes, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
First of all, we might start off with if you could tell us your story, what exactly happened with your experiences.
Well, my own experiences were confined to Montebello. I was conscripted into national service. I was already in the Naval Reserve, so I was put into the Navy for national service. We did 124 days straight up, and then we were recalled each year to put in more time to make up the full 6 month period. It was looked on as an honour, but I look on it as a dubious honour now, to be taken to Montebello for the first British explosion. I was on the River Class frigate Macquarie. At the time of the explosion, we were anchored just near the Sydney, the aircraft carrier, which was the major ship there. All the scientists and what have you were on the... They had the laboratories and things on the good ship Sydney. But they had just about every Australian Navy ship there was, and Papua New Guinea ship, New Zealand ship, and quite a large number of the British ships. The explosion was about 20 past 8 in the morning. It was in the lagoon. It was an old British frigate, the HMS Plym. The actual explosion was about 20 feet underwater. It was in the body of the Plym. It was a massive explosion and no parts of the Plym were ever found. There was this red oxide mixed with the sand, and was taken that was what had been the Plym. Everyone was ignorant in those days. I think the scientists knew more than we did. But I think, like, when there was too much radiation in our drinking water, chlorine was added to the water in the hopes that that would reduce the radiation. What we know now, we know that that was quite foolish, but in those days, not very much was known. The anti-submarine frigates, River-class frigates, just about all of the Australian Navy's frigates. I can't think of any that weren't there. But we had the ASDIC domes lowered, and we were told we were looking for whales, but we knew that we were looking for any suggestion of a Russian submarine. The night before the explosion, a national serviceman on the Culgoa, which was stationed north-west of us, fair way away, he's suffering from appendicitis. So the sick berth attendant said he'd much prefer for the ship to race down and he could put the Nasho onto the Sydney, which had a full sick bay with anaesthetists and surgeons and the like. We were told to take station where the Culgoa was, but we also had to have the ASDIC domes lowered So it was a conflict there. The ship had to speed to get to where the coal goer was, and you can't go too fast with the ASDIC domes lowered. You damage them and you get bad readings. But so eventually, after half a night steaming, we were told to come back and take station alongside the Sydney. And I came off morning watch at 8 o'clock, and I remember I was invited to stand on deck and watch. It's something I'll never forget.
So it was a big excitement then. I mean, you didn't know the dangers of it, so it was like everyone was excited to go out and watch this blast.
We looked on it as being lucky to experience this. Yes, Linda.
We might go to a song, Lou, and then we'll come back and maybe we'll hear the experience of what happened with the actual blast, and then later on in the show we're going to talk about the particular experience at Emu Fields. We're going to hear another song from Justin Mullins now, and this song is called Starlight, the Starlight Foundation. Red's Radical Radio.
Power to Gunsville. Power to Equal.
Monday, 12 to 1 p.m., The Anarchy Show.
Promoting family harmony. Everyone unite. Grassroots evolution. Unified.
Wednesday, 12 to 1 p.m., Radio Democracy. Friday, 9 to 10 a.m., Eco Radio.
Heal the planet.
Portable Z. Agitate, organize.
It's 18 minutes past 12 o'clock, or around about that time. Anyway, you're listening to 4ZZZ, Radio Democracy, and today on Radio Democracy, we're doing a special on the 50th anniversary of the Emu Fields, the first atomic test on the Australian mainland. And Lou Rice is here with me today, with us today, and Lou Rice was actually at Montebello. Lou, can you tell me what actually happened with the atomic bomb? You all sort of went out and watched the explosion?
Yes. In those days, we were a lot more ignorant of the dangers and all facets of the explosions than we are now. And it was looked on as a privilege, or you were lucky, to be able to experience this. That's about every Australian Navy ship that existed at the time was there for the tests, from workboats to, our biggest ship, of course, was the HMAS Sydney, and that was the mothership for the whole of the experience. And most of the British scientists were based on that ship, on the Sydney. And the planes, the naval aircraft at the time, there were Fireflies and Sea Furies. And on the afternoon after the explosions, they were flying in and out of the cloud. But I'd just come off morning watch at 8 o'clock, and my involvement in the experiments was not a great onerous one. I was off-sided to the tanky on the ship, which was might be called a grocer. Anyway, I didn't have to start work for quite a while, and we were all given the opportunity of standing on deck to watch the explosion. It was about 20 past 8 in the morning. As I mentioned, it was in the bowels of the HMS Plym. Well, we were a fair way away, probably 12 miles from memory, and we were told to look away so to not damage our eyes. We looked away, and then we were told we could look towards the explosion site then after probably a minute, but to put our hands over our eyes. I still remember well the first time I'd seen the bones in my hands. You could see the bones through the flesh. Eventually, sand and water came down on us. Some of the sand was like glass. The ocean was just frothed. There was a massive cloud. It wasn't like the mushroom clouds that you see. The cloud went up, and it went west by northwest towards the Australian mainland. Eventually, the Fireflies and Sea Furies were up there flying around. There were Lancasters taking, we understood they had sort of nets in their wings where they could catch the cloud with the radiation in it. And as usual in those sorts of circumstances in the Navy, when there's been underwater explosion, be it a depth charge or a squid, there are fish come to the surface. Well, we pulled in a lot of these fish with landing nets, and we ate them for days until we got a signal from Melbourne telling us under no circumstances were we to eat the fish from the lagoon. But anyway, the cloud drifted away towards the Australian mainland and to our thinking, to our knowledge, oh, well, that's over now. It's because that afternoon we went ashore on one of the Montebello Islands to check the structures, the Nissen huts and different shaped igloos and things to see which ones had withstood the explosion the best. I remember the commander of our ship went ashore and with us. He wore a cap and shorts, and I think something like sand shoes. Most of us had boots and socks and shorts on and wore our caps. What ignorance we suffered from.
You're saying that you walked around on the coral, and to your knowing, the only injury that you got at the time was cuts from the coral.
That's right, Linda. There was the insidious thing with the radiation. You can't see it, so therefore you can lull yourself into a sense of thinking that it doesn't exist. A thing you can't see mustn't exist. But there was no. There was a massive sick bay, a big sick bay on the Sydney, but no one was taken there for any problems. We didn't have any problems. Subsequently, a lot of the ships headed for Shark Bay, where they were hosed down with the salt water in Shark Bay to just clean them. But our ship was one of those which was. We worked with the Korangi, which was it had a lot of divers on board, and we had certain things to do around the experiment site. But eventually we went to Shark Bay to hose down, and some of the bigger ships had moved on from there. But I recall well there was a bit of a hoo-ha that on our ship that the drinking water was reading on a meter that it was radioactive. And I remember this chief petty officer was in charge of the meter which tested the water. And I remember him saying to me, I said, bloody machine, it's just no good. He said, every time I turn it on, with water running through it, the needle just goes right to maximum and burns the damn thing out. He said, I'll have to try and get another one that works properly. But fortunately, for a few days, I drank what were called goffers on board the ship. That it was the water in the goffer machine had been put in there before the explosion. It was only luck, not knowledge, that I drank these coffers, and they were a small cost. It might have been tuppence or something. It still didn't save me from subsequently suffering from stomach cancer, but they're a lot worse than I. At least I'm still alive.
We might go to another song now and then just come back and talk about The number of, I understand it's 70% of the servicemen aren't with us today due to cancer, and talk a bit also about the compensation. You're listening to Radio Democracy on Triple Z 102.1 FM. This